Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's go ahead and prepare to take the test. So if you want to clear the decks of everything but two pens, different colored ink, you'll need the one for the grading. Sure, you can do that first if you'd like. Whichever. Doesn't really matter. But if you're all set, well, I go ahead and slide them forward. Okay. Let's see here. We are going to pass out Minor Prophets, File 5, Test, Amos, and Hosea. Trying to remember, it was you. Mm-hmm. Trying to remember what the... Yes, but now face to face. What the time limit is on this. Seems to me it's only 15 minutes. I think that's what it is. I mean, this is a short test. This is very brief. Only one page, two pages, two and a half. So let's go with that. Because I lost my other test key. So once I give you the go, you'll have 15 minutes. Which will be plenty of time. You'll probably be sitting there staring at me after 10. So, all right. Are you ready? These are all the slides, okay. Everybody has a test. Irate. Ooh. Everybody has a test. Everybody has their name on it. Everybody has a date on it. You may be go begin. You may go begin. Either one. But you have 15 minutes to do it. 15. 50 minuten bitte. Well, nothing. I just had a seat. A case of indigestion.
Thank you. How many are not done? Told you.
Told you it was easy. All right, let's. If you're done, let's grade it. Do the switcheroo.
Put your name on it. Says judge.
Alrighty. Number one, Amos, letter A. Two is B. Three is B. Four is B. Five is D, David. Six is also D. Page two. Number seven is A. Number eight is B. And then Hosea, number one is E. Number two is B. Page three, number three is A. A, and then the matching. Number one, letter I. Number two, J. Number three, A. Number four, G. Five, M, Mary. Six, O. 7, N, Nancy, 8, E, 9, C, and 10 is L. Notice the scoring instructions there. 1 wrong, minus 1, 2 wrong, minus 2. 3 wrong, it goes to minus 4, and so forth. Yes?
I had a question on page 1, question number 6. I took the initial meaning of summer fruit, because it always has a local fulfillment and then it has a prophetic fulfillment. And I took the local fulfillment because the summer fruit represented that judgment was at hand. So I took that as the captivity in the Assyrian army, and then the prophetic fulfillment as Israel's Armageddon.
If I had put, and I know what you're thinking is, as one of the responses, Israel in Amos's day, or sinful Israel in Amos's generation, then that would have been the response, preferred response to D even. But since I put the Assyrian armies, there's no way they're the summer fruit, because he says the end has come upon my people, when in that little play on words there. Mm-hmm. And I know what you're saying, and it wasn't a trick question, but it was just a matter of, according to the responses that were available, what is the interpretation of the verse? And the Assyrian armies were involved in the harvesting of that fruit, you might say, but they were not the summer fruit. All right, if you've scored them, deduct the minus points from 28. Yes?
About page 2, number 7.
Want the answer on that? Page 2, number 7?
Yeah.
A. Letter A. Okay. Yes.
On page 2, number 2, I said circle C because of the 7 years represent that.
Okay, the 70 years is only a little. It's part of the fulfillment, but it's only a blip on the screen. In reference to what this whole verse is saying, because this many days is actually referring to 2,700 years of history from the time that Israel was scattered till the time that they're regathered in the millennium. They haven't had a king, they haven't had a temple or a sacrifice, and they haven't been in actual idolatry. So to take the 70 years as being the fulfillment of it, or the prophetic meaning of it, can't be. It's only actually a little part of it. Okay, go ahead and pass them back to the owner. Owners, double check the math. Pass them forward. And then we'll get back to Micah chapter 1. Hosea, yeah, it goes back in the last year. Okay. We have all the papers? Alrighty. Sir. Some paranomasias. She had that word down. She was ready to spell it, define it, dissect it, dice it. All right. Now, when we left off yesterday, we were talking about paranomasia. And we pointed out that it isn't pointed out in most translations. You just miss it. You don't even know there's any tie-in there in the original. You just don't see it in the translations. But old James Moffat tried to bring that out in his translation. So I'm going to read Moffat's translation on Micah 1, 10 through 14. Weep tears at Tear Town. Now this is verse 10, so you might want to look in the King James and see what they've done with it. So what he's saying is that Gath carries that idea of weeping or tears, and therefore weep tears at Tear Town. Grovel in the dust at Dust Town. And so what he's saying there is that Ophrah carries that idea. And in my King James, there's actually a marginal reading there for Ophrah, and it says dust in the margin. Verse 11, fare forth stripped, O fair town. And so verse 11 then, Saphir, apparently carries the meaning of beauty, or that which is beautiful or fair. So it's a play on words. Their name was Fairtown, but now they're going to be going stripped and naked, which in other words indicates humility and judgment, captivity, and so forth. Kind of like you have a name that you live, but you are dead, you know, Book of Revelation for the one church age. Stirtown dare not stir, Beth Ezel. And so here the idea of the inhabitants of Beth Ezel better not stir and come out of their fortified city, because again the Sennacherib and the Assyrian armies are waiting for them out there. 12, and Meroth hopes in vain, for doom descends from the Eternal to the very gates of Jerusalem. 13, to horse and drive away, O horse town. And that's apparently the idea of Lachish there. O source of Zion's sin, where the crimes of Israel center. 14, O maiden Zion, you must part with Moresheth of Gath. And remember that when we looked at that was the town that Micah was from, and I think I gave the meaning of it, that it means betrothed of Gath. And there was a practice of giving parting gifts to those that were betrothed and then married. We would call it today, you know, wedding gifts type thing. And so he's saying Jerusalem is going to have to part with these cities, these suburb fortified cities that were given to protect it. And so they're going to have to part with Moresheth of Gath, betrothed of Gath. And then Israel's kings are ever balked at Balk Town. And that's Achzib there. He's rendered that as Balk Town. B-A-L-K. You know, to balk is to look like you're going to do something and then you stop at the last minute and you don't do it. You're balking. All right, so that's what he's done with it. And, you know, it's a little awkward because it's so difficult to try to really carry it over from one language to another. I'm sure it didn't seem anywhere near as artificial as this when you looked at it in the original, you know, the way it was laid out. But the point is still the same, and that is he's making these connections here between the meanings of the names of the towns and what's going to be happening to them. Just like the Bible often makes a connection between the meanings of people's names and what happened to them prophetically. You know, Isaac, laughter, and Abraham, father of many nations, and so on and so forth. All right, going back then and looking at these verses briefly, verse 10. Declare ye it not at Gath. So we already talked about this. The Philistines will only rejoice over the defeat of God's people. In Ophrah, verse 10, does mean house of dust. He called it Dust Town. And that's another Philistine town, by the way. To roll thyself, of course, in that society, they would often throw themselves down on the ground if it was a mourning and lamentation, and even roll in the dust. So again, he's saying he's going to bring mourning and lamentation upon them because of the Assyrians.
Is to discern the inward. What is going on inside of people that is motivating them to behave in a certain way? That behavior being a conflict of some type. God is a primary source of wisdom. Another source of wisdom is what God has revealed to the Christian church at large. We need to discern the entire body of Christ as potentially being anointed of God, led of God, experiencing God, and experiencing things that we are not experiencing. I wish the body of Christ would discern us as experiencing certain things that perhaps they could greatly benefit from. But let us not make the same mistake they make.
11, pass ye away, thou inhabitant of Saphir. Again, Saphir is from a Hebrew word for beauty. And so the point here is their beauty is being changed to nakedness, to shame. The inhabitant of Zaanan came not forth in the morning of Beth-Ezel. And this is another play on words, because Zaanan literally means going forth. But the inhabitants of Zaanan did not go forth to help the town of Beth-Ezel in their siege. They remained in their own city through fear of the enemy. So they had a name that says going forth, but they did not go forth. Beth-Ezel means near house, near house. And possibly he's saying here that the calamity is going to come near to you. It's going to come right to near house, but it's not even going to stop there. It's going to come right to your own house. 12, the inhabitant of Meroth waited carefully for good. Meroth means bitterness. Remember Mara or Naomi in the book of Ruth, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. See, same root there. Bitterness, the Lord has dealt with me bitter, and I'm bitter and so forth. So here the inhabitants of Meroth waited for anxiously for news of better fortune from the war front, but it was only in vain, and it was going to be bitterness. 13, O inhabitant of Lachish, bind the chariot to the swift beast. And to escape destruction. And yet, Lachish was a fortified city. So when the inhabitants of a well-fortified city have to get on their horse and ride away, then the implication is they've been defeated and they're fleeing for their very lives. Now, this is an interesting statement here, too. Concerning Lachish, it says, she is the beginning of the sin to the daughter of Zion, for the transgressions of Israel were found in thee. We don't know exactly what he means by this, but that is, it's obvious that he's signaling out this city for a greater rebuke. And apparently what he's saying is that it was the first city in Judah to import Israel's idolatry into the southern kingdom. She was the beginning of the sin to the daughter of Zion. NAS renders, see, because it says, for the transgressions of Israel, northern kingdom, were found in thee. NAS renders, she was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, because in you were found the rebellious acts of Israel. So that's what he seems to be saying, that it came to Lachish first and then it spread from there. But this is all we know, because the historical books are silent on this point. However, it would not be surprising that Israel's Baal worship might initially come to Lachish, because Lachish was near Philistia, number one, which is a heathen country in which there was Baal worship. And Lachish was near the tribal allotment of Dan. And Dan was a tribe that was known for its unfaithfulness to God. It was known for its idolatry. And so perhaps through Dan it came to Lachish. Possibly. Here, Judges chapter 18, verse 30, which I'll read quickly. Judges 18, 30. And the children of Dan set up the graven image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershon, the son of Manasseh, he and his sons were priests unto the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. So setting up graven images in Dan. Also, Lachish was formerly an Amorite city prior to its occupation by Joshua and the Israelites. And there's a possibility that there was just a kind of a carryover there from the idolatrous worship of the Amorites, the previous inhabitants of the city. Anyway, that's all speculation. All we know for sure is what it says here, and that is that there was some. She was the beginning of that sin of Israel for Jude in the nation of Judah. All right. Let's see. 14. Therefore shalt thou give presents to Moresheth Gath, and remember that means betrothed of Gath. So Micah's own hometown is going to be taken by the enemy during this Sennacherib's invasion. You will give presents, and the Hebrew is parting gifts. Parting gifts. Now really there's another way of looking at that from what I mentioned a minute ago, and that is when a man wrote a woman a bill of divorcement in the Old Testament economy, he had to give her parting gifts. It was not unlike what today is called alimony, you know, or support or a division of the goods according to a community property law or something like that. And so what he could be looking at it from the standpoint of Jerusalem, you're going to be divorced from Moresheth Gath. You're going to lose it. You're going to have to give it up. And so you might as well give them parting gifts. Achzib. He says, the houses of Achzib shall be a lie to the kings of Israel. And Achzib means deception or lie. Like a brook that becomes dry. You know, those small streams which are called wadis, which can be a raging torrent during the rainy season, and in a very short time you can return and it can be nothing but dust. And so it's like a deception or a lie, because you expect it to be there. It seems like it should be there. There should be water, something you could count on, but so often it is not. And so this is what the city will be to the kings of Israel, meaning they won't be able to depend on it now. It's going to be gone. 15, yet will I bring an heir unto thee, O inhabitant of Merisha, he shall come into Adullam, the glory of Israel. It's actually got the article here, the heir or the possessor unto them. And this is a continuation of this prophecy of Sennacherib's invasion. And he's saying, you, and again it's a play on words because Merisha means an inheritance. So the heir or possessor is going to come to the inheritance and he's going to receive it. In other words, he took these cities and they became, as it were, his portion or his inheritance. And then Adullam, he shall come unto Adullam, the glory of Israel. Adullam, meaning is uncertain here. Young feels that it means resting place. In any case, it was apparently a city that had a very superior situation, and therefore the idea of glory, Adullam, the glory of Israel. However, some transpose this sentence and render it rather, the glory of Israel will enter Adullam. The glory of Israel will enter Adullam. So glory becomes the subject of the sentence in this case. And they make it a messianic prophecy as a result. Now, New American Standard, Rotherham, Lang, and a number of others take it this way. Now, if we take it the other way first, the negative, then he is coming to Adullam. Again, it's the leaders fleeing to Adullam from Sennacherib, just like David did in his own time, to the same city. But if we turn it around, like some do, then it becomes a messianic prophecy where the glory of God is coming to his resting place. You know, like in Psalm 132, Zion, here, if I desired it, this is my... In which case, maybe the first part of the verse is messianic as well, where the heir, definite article, is coming unto his inheritance. See? Now, again, we look at it, we say, well, seems like it's stretching it a little bit because the whole context is negative, it's judgment on Israel. But hey, you look at a lot of these fulfillments of some of these prophecies in the New Testament, and you'll see them plucked right out of the middle of a negative context, the context of judgment. You see messianic prophecy. So I don't think it's necessarily improper hermeneutics to see a messianic prophecy there. In fact, we'll get into some places in Zechariah where it's even hairier. You look at some of these contexts and it looks like, man, there's no way that could be messianic. And yet you look at the verse and there's no way it couldn't be messianic. It's just the way it's stated is so clear. So we'll be looking at that a little bit later on. 16, make thee bald and poll thee for thy delicate children. Enlarge thy baldness as the eagle, for they are gone into captivity from thee. Now, of course, baldness was a token of mourning. Now, God never told them to cut their hair off, but the heathen did it, and so Israel did it. And so God, knowing that they did it, says, do it. Not that he wants them to do it, but he's just showing what they're going to be doing in their mourning. It was actually prohibited in Deuteronomy chapter 14 and verse 1, but it was practiced nevertheless, like a lot of things that God prohibited. Token of mourning. Here you can also put Ezra 9:3 and Job 1:20. To pull the means to shave the hair off. So it's just the same thing. NAS renders, make yourself bald and cut off your hair. And again, because of your delicate children, that is, the children of your delight, they're now gone. And enlarge your baldness as the eagle or the vulture, either way, bald or having the appearance of being bald, one or the other. For they will go from you into exile. All right, so that's chapter 1. Yes?
15, that the year.
Uh-huh.
Is it we apply that first to Sennacherib? Is that what it says?
Right. That was my first... That's what I felt was the interpretation, that he was being considered an inheritor in the sense that he was coming to these cities and he was appropriating them. And in this prism, he talks about all of the people that he took captive and all of the animals and the treasures and so forth. Mm-hmm. Yes, Robbie.
Clear on verse 16, it referred to the day for the exile. Who is that? That was the exile. I don't quite understand that.
It's the people of... that Sennacherib took. He took over 200,000 Jews.
Not the children.
No, I don't think it's saying children as opposed to adults. But oftentimes God will personify the nation as a whole as though it was the mother or the father or the parents, and then the actual inhabitants of the nation in any particular generation are likened to its children.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so no, it's adults and children both in actuality that are going here. Okay. All right, chapter 2. Woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil upon their beds. When the morning is light, they practice it, because it is in the power of their hand. So here we're given a picture of the people of Judah laying on their beds at night and scheming, devising ways of committing evil the next day, you know, robbery, extortion, coercion, blackmail, whatever. And so they're devising this ahead of time. NAS renders, who scheme iniquity, who work out evil on their beds. So this is not something that's done in the heat of passion or on sudden impulse, but this is something that is done by deliberate, premeditated design, which makes it much worse. You know, it's a presumptuous or high-handed sin rather than a stumbling or a fault. And then when the daytime comes, they execute these evil plans, because it is in the power of their hand, or literally, for their hand is for a god. Unusual statement. For their hand is for a god. Then I believe what it's saying is that the hand here represents their plans and their powers, their abilities, and it has become a god to them. You know the old saying, might makes right. In some people's philosophy, in a Machiavellian philosophy, might does make right. And so their power passes as a god to them. All they really worship, in a sense, is power and influence and, you know, evil and so on. As opposed to what the man of God is exhorted to do and to meditate on his bed, we read in Psalm 63:6, when I remember thee upon my bed and meditate on thee in the night watches. So the man of God is remembering God at night and thinking about his own life and letting God deal with him. But these people are just figuring out what kind of evil they can commit the next day. I think the communists are a tremendous illustration of this too. Their hand is for a god. In other words, their power. You know, on May Day, they roll out all the missiles and the cannons and the tanks and everything, and they glory, you know, in their military might and in their power. Our nation does too, I think, to an inordinate extent. But not like the Soviets, because our nation is still at least pays lip service to the Almighty and to the fact that we are supposedly one nation under God. Well, they've taken that away, and now it's just, you know, we are a god unto ourselves. It's secular humanism, deification of man and his powers and abilities, which were given him by God, and that he was created in the image of God, but now he's worshiping the creature more than the creator. Verse 2, and they covet fields. So here's some of the things that they've been meditating on, how they can take things and take them by violence. And houses, and take them away. So they oppress a man and his house, even a man and his heritage. So this is probably things that were perpetrated mostly by the rich and the mighty in Judah, and they were oppressing the poor. They were oppressing people who had no, who did not have the wherewithal to defend themselves, because there was corruption even in high places. So the poor couldn't expect to get justice and judgment when they came before the judges of the land, because it was collusion. Now, one of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not covet. You're not to covet or desire that which is not yours. So coveting fields could typify coveting anything that's not yours, even a ministry. Because the fields are white unto harvest refers to the ministry. And so people that want something that has been given to somebody else that isn't theirs to have or to desire could be coveting someone's field. Verse 3, therefore thus saith the Lord, behold, against this family do I devise an evil. Now this is a little sarcasm here, because they were devising iniquity on their beds, verse 1, now he's devising an evil against them. From which you shall not remove your necks, neither shall you go haughtily, for this time is evil. So because they are devising evil against their brethren, God is devising evil against them. And of course, when he says an evil, that's qualified. It's not God perpetrating moral wrong, but it's God allowing the Assyrians or later on the Babylonians to come in and judge them or overtake them. And when the people look upon it, they say that an evil thing has befallen us. Jesus said that if you will not forgive your brother, God will not forgive you. So again, we see that the relationship between the horizontal and the vertical, that as we relate to one another, God will relate to us. Judge not, lest ye be judged. Matthew 6:14. And he says, you're not going to go haughtily from this. You won't remove your necks from it. Necks here may be an agricultural analogy of the stubborn ox that doesn't want to put his neck under the yoke because he knows what it means. As soon as he hears the rattle of that yoke come out of the barn, the shed, he knows what's ahead. And he does everything possible to try to keep from going under that yoke. And he says, you're not going to remove your necks from this one. You are going to go into this judgment, into this bondage. You will not go haughtily. Literally, you will not walk loftily. And now maybe he's mixed his metaphors or transferred it to a human idea of people walking in with a superior air and attitude or stiff-necked. Every time I read this verse, I think of high fashion magazines and the ads, men and women, particularly women, the poses that and the spirits, the stance that the photographers make them take, with these clothes, and it's always so snooty, just snoot pusses. They're always just so haughty and so superior. And of course they're trying to portray something. They're trying to say if you wear Givenchy perfume, or Christian Dior gowns or whatever, you will be superior. Everybody will be below you, and they will love you, and they will worship you and adore you, But it's a stench. It doesn't draw me at all, quite frankly, because there's such a icky attitude to me that is portrayed by that. Now, they're not all that way, but a lot of them are. A lot of them are. And I'm not saying the women are that way. They're pretty much, they're in a job where they have to do what they're told to do. But I doubt that they can go through that day after day, year after year, and not somehow be affected by it. I'd be surprised if they weren't. Maybe they aren't. I don't know. I'm not their judge. Now where he says, for this time is evil. You could possibly render it that, not this, but that is evil time. And again, what he's saying is that time when this comes upon you, the time of your captivity, will be an evil time, and it will be a time that you will not escape from. For in that day shall one take up a parable against you, and lament with a doleful lamentation, and say, we be utterly spoiled. He has changed the portion of my people. How has he removed it from me? Turning away, he has divided our fields. So in that day, one of their foes, in derision, would take up a lamentation. Or one of their own. Now, turning away, he has divided our fields. This could be rendered, to the apostate, he has divided our fields. Or to the rebellious one, he has divided our fields. Meaning, here, these were our fields, this was our inheritance, and God has given it to the apostate, which is, of course, a reference to Assyria. Because they had apostatized way back, well, they'd go back to the Tower of Babel, basically, Nimrod, who was the founder of Babylon and Assyria, was the typifying the devil and the Antichrist, the apostate one. So just to the heathen nations, even in general, God's people have often lost the inheritance that they had.
Yeah.
And they've given it up, and it's gone back to the apostate one.
Right.
You know, like Esau selling his inheritance or his birthright for a bowl of lentils. And there's three different forms of the same word here in lament with a doleful lamentation. That word doleful is also a form of the word lament or lamentable. So Rotherham renders it, you will lament with a lamentable lamentation. So that's a whole lot of lamenting going on there. Verse 5, therefore thou shalt have none that shall cast a cord by lot in the congregation of the Lord. Now, the land was originally divided up among the tribes and the families, and they would use cords or lines in order to mark it off, the boundaries. And so, but now they're not going to have anybody among themselves that will have an inheritance. They're going to lose their possession in the land. When Israel rejected the prophets, they lost their physical inheritance, and they were carried to Israel and Judah to Babylon. But when Israel rejected the prophet of prophets, they lost their spiritual inheritance, and they were carried away into all the nations. We read in Acts 13:46 that Paul and Barnabas waxed bold and said, it was necessary that the word of God should have first been spoken to you, but seeing you put it from you and judge yourselves unworthy of everlasting life, lo, we turn to the Gentiles. That was them losing their inheritance right there. Acts 13:46, and it's very similar to a statement in Acts 28:28. So I guess that's the last bell for this week and next week. But we'll see you a week from Wednesday, right? 2 weeks from yesterday. We had a little break here. Have a good camp meeting. Get all rested up. 28:28 says, be it known therefore unto you that the salvation of God is sent unto the Gentiles, and that they will hear it. Okay.
Greg, in doing the outline for this, just reviewing the book for the test, Isaiah especially, and I could see.